Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hey, welcome to Saturday Supercast, episode 4, Living It Live, and 10 points to anybody who knows which cartoon I lifted that title from. It wasn't a title, it was actually a line spoken by a character. With me today, to start out with, it's Mark Rudolph of CVComics.com.
Hello.
And Sean Robert of BrandedInThe80s.com.
Hey, what's up?
So, to start with, while we're waiting for other folks to get here, Sean sent me a fantastic topic for discussion. Part of the model, so to speak, for Sugary Cereals is to create, in creating Saturday morning style entertainment, part of one component of a lot of Saturday morning cartoons was having not necessarily a moral agenda, but more of making sure that it wasn't harmful to kids. And some, there were different shows that went to different degrees for that. Like, for instance, He-Man. Every episode ended with a moral, and the stories tended to kind of wrap themselves around that moral, whereas G.I. Joe, not so much, although there was certainly some pro-social material in the story. So, and this kind of ties in, Sean, to something you've been doing on your site with the reviews of the Dungeons & Dragons TV series. Did you want to start with that, like talking about one of the pitfalls of writing, quote-unquote, moral material?
Sure. Did you want to talk about Mark Evanier's quote on, or thoughts on the Eric character?
Yeah. I think that's a good starting point.
Okay. I've been reading on Evanier's blog about his involvement in creating the series bible for the show, and how he had when he was setting up the characters, or whittling down the characters that were already written, he was sort of brought on later to revamp the show. The producers of the show, I think under pressure from parents groups and stuff, but I'm not positive about that, wanted to make sure that there was a character that was basically there to screw it up for the group, so that there would be sort of... they could get across an idea that there's a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do, and this character would always bring up maybe the wrong thing to do by sort of splitting off from the group or wanting to do something that was maybe a little bit more selfish or something.
Yeah, the Mr. Bungle character.
Yeah, which, of course, ends up being Eric, the Cavalier. And it's funny that one of the issues that kind of brings up is that in order to have a character always... be wrong like that, it sort of makes it seem like it's only right when the entire group agrees on something, and that if you have any kind of different ideas, or if you're thinking out of the box or what have you, that inherently there's got to be something wrong with that because the rest of the group doesn't want to do it.
And that is an interesting potential pitfall to in making stories like that I've thought about in the past. Years ago, in my long, geeky conversations with Hoover about cartoons like the Transformers and things like that, we realized that we had an affinity for certain bad guys. And not because they were bad necessarily, not that they were fulfilling any kind of fantasy on my part that I wanted to shoot people in the back and laugh about it, but more to the extent that just there was something about Starscream that was incredibly compelling. What was it about him? And as we pared it down through the conversation, it was like, well, he kind of was confident of himself. He knew who he was. He owned himself, and he knew he was the best, and he just wanted everybody else to acknowledge that. And so there was this kind of individualistic attitude about him where he stood apart. All the other Decepticons, if you go back and watch the early seasons, they ask permission to do anything. Soundwave totally just follows Megatron around and is deferential to him. Skywarp, there's an exact line, geek alert here. Skywarp actually says, Skywarp to Megatron, request permission to teleport, and Megatron says, permission granted. Starscream doesn't ask permission. He just does what he wants. And there's a little bit of that in a lot of Saturday morning cartoon villains, which could easily be misconstrued as, being an individualist, being self-assured, and kind of give the kids a mixed message. Now, for me, it didn't give me necessarily a mixed message. I didn't go around punching people, but I kind of assimilated what I liked about Starscream and kind of used that as almost a heroic template. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
So, it's interesting that, you have to distill the characters into one-sentence descriptions, and a lot of writers say that, but at the same time, you have to be careful because, yeah, you could run into a pitfall where you essentially make a bad guy seem like, like you were also saying, like this notion of, like, if you don't fall on the line, then you're a bad guy. That was on Dungeons & Dragons. There was a little bit of that on the Snorks, because the Snorks you had, it was less of an army fighting thing. It was more of a bunch of kids going to school under the sea, right?
Yeah. Well, you get that in, like, the Smurfs, too, with, like, Brainy Smurf is sort of a Starscream to Papa Smurf's Megatron.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And what happens to Brainy Smurf whenever he starts acting more particularly brainy?
They throw him out of the village.
And he lands on his head upside down. Every time the guy expresses himself, that's the result, you know? So that is an interesting...
Very communist.
It almost is. It's almost anti-American, isn't it? I'm wondering, though, if we can look back and if that happened a lot in He-Man or not.
Not sure. I know most of the secondary villains were pretty... Well, Evil Lynn was kind of sure of herself, I think. But a lot of the other ones were just so bungling and orders following.
I don't know. Well, I guess it was less about a group dynamic. Like, He-Man had, like, kind of a rotating cast, even though it was about a basic group of heroes. There was a little bit more of, like, here's an episode where it's all about Ram Man and Manny Faces, you know. Well, Mark, did you have any thoughts on writing characters like that? Well, you don't write anything that's like a team dynamic either.
Nope.
Not yet. Well, you got the Galactic League.
Yeah, that's only three people, though, so... Or two people, technically.
I'm thinking of shows like G.I. Joe, though, where there was less of that fall into line thing. I mean, I guess because the personalities were bigger and bouncing off each other, but it always worked out okay. You had less and less of a guy who was the Mr. Bungle character. Like, this is the character who's going to represent the bad decision. Like, everybody had a potential to make a bad decision, right?
Yeah.
Like, you think of episodes like Cold Slither, where Shipwreck and I forget who else, those three Joes go to that concert, they get hypnotized by the...
Oh, Breaker and...
Yeah.
God, I can't think of the other guy's name right now. Too early in the morning for me.
but they make the bad decision, and in the end, Duke's like, well, I'm going to have to reprimand you guys. And then there's other characters like Snake Eyes disobeys a direct order in another episode, and... You know,
yeah.
It's like, you disobeyed my order. So everybody had the potential to do the wrong thing. So and it's been a while since I've watched Dungeons & Dragons, Sean. How do you feel that the characterization stacks up between, say, that show and something like G.I. Joe? Was G.I. Joe, like, particularly more sophisticated in its writing, or no?
I think it was, actually, because it wasn't... Being a syndicated show, I don't think it was held back as much. It wasn't trying to be shoehorned into a specific style as much. On Dungeons & Dragons, a lot of the characters definitely fell into the same exact character pattern. They always reacted the same. So they didn't really get a lot of chance to grow. Probably around the second or third season, I think some of the writers started trying to break that up a little bit, where there's actually a couple episodes where Eric wants to split off from the group, and his ideas actually work. There's one in particular where he challenges Dungeon Master, saying stuff like, you know, you're always giving us all these cryptic messages, I could do a much better job than you. And Dungeon Master gives like, okay, fine, then you're Dungeon Master for the day. And what's funny is, as the episode plays out, everything actually sort of works out. His ideas gel. It's just, he's got all this weird power that he probably shouldn't have. But yeah, it took a good two seasons or so to get to that point, where I think shows like G.I. Joe started off there a little bit, you know, earlier. The way they had a rotating cast and stuff like that, it was easier to, you know, the characters could react to the situation and do different things, whereas in Dungeons & Dragons, it's always the same, you know,
yeah,
six characters or so.
Well, there's lesson learned there, I think, is that when I'm reading your Dungeons & Dragons breakdowns on your website, brandedinthe80s.com, I see a very strong similarity in structure between what the model for Dungeons & Dragons is and shows like Beast Wars, which, Sean, we've talked about before, but although you haven't seen it yet, I don't think. But it's essentially it's the Gilligan's Island syndrome, where you got a small group of people trapped in this environment, and you kind of I went to BotCon 97, nerd alert, I went to BotCon 97, Transformers convention, and Bob Ford was there, and he was talking about writing Beast Wars. And he said the thing about that show was they didn't have many options. Because computer animation was so expensive, they couldn't just bring in new characters whenever they wanted to. So they had to really pitch these characters against each other, and they turned the volume up on them really loud and banged them against each other. And because of that, you got all this great character development that maybe what I'm getting at here is a lesson learned is that if you're doing a story where you have a small core group of characters trapped in an environment and the whole story is the Gilligan's Island syndrome where it's like, well, we just want to get home kind of thing, you really need to make sure that those characters are loud and that you bang up against each other as much as you can. And maybe they didn't do that as much in Dungeons & Dragons?
No, they didn't. There was... It didn't really... Because I think in order to do that, you know, to turn the volume up and everything, it's like you have to put the characters in situations where they'd be given a chance to do something different or crazy or something that's a little out of scope. With Dungeons and Dragons, at least for the first season, you know, the characters weren't really put in situations like that. It seemed like they were, it was basically the same plot over and over and over again. Just, you know, insert new ingredients, but basic same plot.
Okay. So it was one of the earlier Sunbow projects, as far as, like, it wasn't as developed as the later syndicated stuff that came out.
Yeah, no.
And maybe there were, maybe because of, like, the probably because of parents' groups, because I remember like a 2020 special, or maybe it was 60 Minutes, that it came out in the early 80s, where they were really saying like, oh my gosh, these new new cartoons that are part of a toy line are just turning kids into mindless consumers, they're poison, you know, like John Stossel or whatever his name is on there, saying like, oh my goodness, this stuff is just going to pollute our children's minds because... you know, unless parent groups watch this to make sure that it doesn't encourage them to go to playgrounds and punch each other in the face yelling Cobra, you know, that kind of thing.
I remember when I was going to church in the early 80s, when I was forced into doing that, there was a huge kind of brouhaha about G.I. Joe as well. They're trying to ban it in all the local stores because of the, you know, the violent aspect.
Okay. So see, that's what I'm wondering, like, if there was like an undue amount of pressure on the earlier shows. And I know in the case of He-Man, it was internal. It was all from, who was Lou Scheimer's buddy?
Hal Sutherland?
Hal Sutherland. He was the one who was saying, like, you know, he changed an episode where, or was it, maybe it was Lou Scheimer, where he changed an episode where Faker falls off a cliff because they made it look like He-Man inadvertently allowed that to happen, but then they had to change it so that He-Man couldn't stop him from falling off the cliff because otherwise he's not quite as heroic, you know, being very, very careful about what they put into the action elements of the show.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that still stems from the fact that there was a big push, I think in the late 60s and then definitely through the 70s, where they pretty much tried to remove all violence from cartoons, all violent aspects. And it wasn't until like 84 or so that they started breaking away from that after He-Man, after Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
Sort of opened the window.
Right. Yeah, and they pretty much had succeeded throughout the 70s. I don't remember very many television shows in the 70s with any kind of action element to it. It was all pretty much mystery-solving teens or Snagglepuss kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to stop this conversation dead, but we do have other people who are showing up to the show, and they are dialed in. They are muted for now. I just want to let you know, Andrea Peterson is here from No Rest for the... Well, actually, her comic's called No Rest for the Wicked, but her site is called ForTheWicked.net. And we also have Julian Helundon. If either of you guys want to come into the conversation, just raise your hand. There should be a little button over next to your phone icon or above it at the top that you can click to let us know that you want to be a part of it. Otherwise, we're just going to keep riffing about cartoon writing theory. So if you want to steer us away from that at any time. And Andrea, I will be letting you in a little bit because we got to talk a little bit about our project coming up for Sugary Cereals. But so this deserves to be an entire podcast in and of itself, just talking about infusing morality / educational content into your work and whether or not... whether or not you even should, and how mindful should you be of it? You know, that's a question. That's a pretty good question right there. Is this something where you set out to say, this episode is going to be about sharing? Or are you just going to, like, you know, while you're writing the episode about something else, about just an exciting event, do you try to find a place to put that stuff? Mark, do you have any thoughts on that?
My stuff doesn't, it's not overtly moral, not like the He-Man. I don't really have an agenda and set out to, you know, have a specific moral lesson in each story. It's more, I think, just kind of like, you know, good versus evil kind of thing. Mm-hmm. More so than, you know, setting out to say, well, you should always share and, you know, this will make fruitful friendships for the rest of your life kind of thing. But I think when you approach it more for the agenda, like, okay, this episode is going to be all about, you know, noticing that people with disabilities are just as good as, you know, everybody else or better, well, whatever. I think when you approach it from the more like that social, pro-social aspect, sometimes it kind of like waters down the story and you're focusing too much on getting your point across instead of really, you know, like doing anything with your characters. But
What do you
that's
think,
just from, like with He-Man, say like He-Man versus, I don't know if you've seen much Brave Star, but I just watched a couple of these recently, and those are, you know, that's Filmation like 5 years later, and instead of having really heavy-handed messages, I mean, instead of, you know, like, don't do drugs, it's bad. It's like, don't do drugs because they'll kill you, and this kid in this episode just died from drugs, so don't do them.
Right, you were telling me about that, and I need to watch that show. I never watched
it. Those were all the really, like, heavy episodes are all written by Bob Forward as well.
Well, the guy's awesome.
Yeah.
Not that he's listening, but if he is, Bob. I love you.
Call me.
Well, you know, I kind of ride a fence on that. I think that I tend to feel a little bit more like there's a place. Well, not that you're saying there isn't a place for the He-Man stuff, but I tend to like kind of really liked some of those episodes where He-Man says, Sky Tree, in fact, any tree has as much right to life as you or me or anybody else. We cannot take a life to save a life. And I get all, you know, pearly-eyed and clutch my blanket, you know.
Yeah.
I tend to get more sentimental about those episodes. So I think those are kind of cool, too. As a matter of fact, I'm writing one for Sugary Cereals. I'm co-creating a comic with my wife, which I will not announce the title of until she can come onto the show and talk about it with me. But we're working on something that I'm modeling specifically after that style of writing, where the characters stop the action to say, here's what our, you know, moral message is. And it does feel a little bit more decompressed than, say, writing something like Equalizers, where I'm really trying to focus on the action and the plot and getting from point A to point B to point C and looking for any kind of downtime in between to sneak in any kind of pro-social messages, if any at all. Sean, how do you feel about that? Do you notice that there's any kind of difference in quality between shows where it's not as important, where it's not as loud in the story as between where it is?
Sometimes. I was watching... There was a show that came out like right at the end of the 80s or right at the beginning of the 90s, Prince Valiant. And I had never seen it in first run. And I picked up the DVD set and I was watching some of the episodes. And it amazed me how... I'm trying to think of the word here. It just came off amazingly heavy-handed because in every single episode... They completely and totally focused on that message. So it's like, you know, the don't cut this tree down because yada yada. And it took a lot away from the show because the message got in the way of who the characters were. The characters were there just to facilitate the message. So it's like every character was just so goody-two-shoes. They just became sort of interchangeable. And it really affected the quality of the show. It's like, as far as just... storytelling goes.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I also tend to think with moral content and stuff like that, and you had mentioned an idea of, like, you know, you can boil it all moral stuff down to, at the end of the day, like, you know, be nice to others and don't tell lies. And when you're writing for, you know, characters like this, and it's like at the end of the day, if you're writing heroic characters, you know, more or less, I think people just have ingrained in them more or less what a heroic character will and won't do, that, you know, you can realize it in the writing when you're pushing the envelope or when they're stepping over a line where it seems like, you know, if you're writing a story where you want Superman to kill someone, you know, you kind of have to stop and think, well, this doesn't just seem right for the character. So I think as long as you stay, you know, if you've got like a basic moral compass, if you don't think about trying to instill a moral, if you're just writing the characters as they are, doing the things that you're pretty sure that they would do, I think at the end of the day, the moral stuff comes through, even if it's not as heavy-handed or not as specific. You may not be able to point to a specific thing saying, you know, well, this was the theme of this episode, or this is the, you know, the whatever of this comic or something. But, it, you know, it's, I think it can be done very naturalistically and have it, you know, not interfere with the storytelling. But at the same time, I don't think it's you know, it would be just so easy to just all of a sudden it's going to turn into like a Sin City comic or a, I don't know, like just, I can't think of a cartoon example where it really steps over the line, but.
Well, maybe like if you, I don't know if you remember G.I. Joe Extreme, that one started getting a little edgier than your typical cartoon. I remember it feeling very edgy for my taste, but.
Was that the D cartoon?
Oh, no, it was, it came out in 96, and Bill Sienkiewicz did all the designs, which, and there was, like, a lot of heavy blacks, and there were, like truly insane characters, like, they were in, like, an insane asylum kind of thing, where they were, like, kind of dangerous Hannibal Lecter-type guys and stuff. Do you remember that, Mark?
Yeah, it didn't work very well at all. Well, it was just basically, like, taking G.I. Joe and injecting a bunch of 90s and, you know, extreme and adrenaline into it, and just kind of fell flat.
I don't know, maybe we need to watch it again. I mean, Gary Chalk played, what was it, Sergeant Stone or Lieutenant Stone or whatever he was.
I think it only had a pilot, didn't it?
I don't remember.
I think I got, like, a pilot with an action figure, which were pretty awful.
Which had a cameo by Cobra Commander, and then he's just gone. And then it's all that guy with the skull face. So is it, like, Scar? Captain Scar?
Was it that, or was that Sergeant Savage?
He carried over to Sergeant Savage carried over to G.I. Joe Extreme.
Okay. I forget which was, that was a weird era in G.I. Joe lore right there, but.
Yeah, that was that's weird little tributary to go down if you want to go down there, but, I think Sean raised a good point. I mean, he said naturalistically, I think that's a good choice of words, or organically, you know,
mm-hmm.
You can weave it into there. You know, you make little very intentional spoken lines in the story where you don't have to stop everything dead to say, like for instance in He-Man where he stops to say, here's the message, kids, I'm not going to cut down a tree.
Well, I think there's a difference too. If you're like the story that you and your wife are working on, you're self-aware of that fact. It's not like, okay, here's what the psychologist advisor told us that we should probably put in the episode.
True.
You know, so you're coming at it from a different angle too.
Well, yeah, so it probably will not quite feel like a He-Man episode, but it's definitely inspired by He-Man kind of.
But ways. You're trying to get more the good feelings that come from that, you know, like just having this, like, it's, you know, like a Superman kind of character telling you that, you know, you shouldn't do this, okay?
Yeah. I talk about this a lot in private conversations and probably in the podcast before. Like, one of the goosebumps moments for me is watching Superman 2 when he comes in with the American flag at the end, stands on top of the, was it the White House or the Capitol building? I'm not sure, but he says, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I won't let you down again. And then he flies off in outer space and winks at the camera.
that's fantastic right there.
Oh, my God. I love that kind of hero. I'm such a sucker for it. But, yeah, so, like, that's the kind of hero that I'm trying to do in that story with my wife, is that kind of, you know, all-American, really good person thing. But I mean, that said, here's an example I always talk about for how G.I. Joe did it very naturalistically, very organically, is, nerd alert again, two-parter, Captives of Cobra. I don't know if you guys remember this one where Cobra puts all the little mind control implants on the Joe's family members, Shipwreck's nephew, Jesse, or his cousin, Jesse,
brother, and
right. And so the Joes have to fight their own families, and they won't do it and everything. And Duke's family members are not even in the group, right? And
mm-hmm.
Duke's job is he's got that giant truck full of these explosive crystals that he's got to get to the away from this town so they can detonate them out in the desert harmlessly. And he winds up getting embroiled in the firefight with the family members. And in the end, it's down to Jesse. I'm going to spoil this episode for those who haven't seen it, but this episode's like over 20 years old, so I don't feel too bad. In the end, Jesse's like, he's this little boy. He's got like this gun. He's going to smash the crystals. The Baroness is like screaming in his ear, smash the crystals, in effect blowing them all up. And In the 0 hour, the kid breaks control, or rather, Joe's destroyed the machine that's controlling him, so he breaks control, and Duke comes up to the kid, pulls the mind control thing off his head, and he just kind of looks up at the sky, and he says boiling voice, just, "When I get my hands on you, Baroness," and he crushes it. And he's infuriated because she, you know, endangered a child, you know? And he didn't say that. He didn't come out and say, "I'm so mad that she endangered this child, and I'm going to get her for it." And on top of it, he was expressing rage, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but at the same time, it was like the most wholesome rage you've ever seen in your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was like passionate care for this child.
Right, you're right. It was Michael Bell's delivery, of course. You know, it's even that much better, because he's like the most white bread all-American voice in the entire universe. So yeah, that's an example of where, like, I compare that to the kind of hero He-Man was, but he's just expressing it. He has a completely different inflection, a little bit more edgier inflection of that kind of hero. And it was infused more naturalistically, and maybe people are picking up on it, maybe not. They're not spelling it out, but it can be done in ways where you just take an opportunity. Here's a moment where the story requires him to say something to close out the scene, and they chose to do something that kind of shows this kind of moral idea of endangering children is probably a bad idea. Duke doesn't like it anyway, so if you like Duke, you shouldn't do that. And as far as I'm trying to think of, like, my upcoming pieces for Sugary Cereals, The Equalizers, that one is... That one has a little bit less like G.I. Joe, a little bit more like He-Man, where the characters are actually saying a little bit of what the moral tale is at the end. And I think Curse of the Pharaohs is more like G.I. Joe in that it happens more naturalistically.
Yeah, it's more like the heroic characters act a certain way and the evil characters act a certain way kind of thing. But
yeah.
I think through more episodes or more issues of that, it'll kind of be more apparent. But even in the Galactic League stuff we're doing, there's, like, veiled messages there as well. I don't know if they're messages or just kind of, like, you know, road signs saying, you know, you probably shouldn't act this way or otherwise these things could happen to you. But
I think Galactic League, and people can look at the first episode to see what we're talking about. I think that the messages are a little bit more veiled by the fact that the comedy aspect, the fact that we play up the villains to be so humorous.
And actually, the moral messages are almost coming from the villains.
Really? Like what?
Huh?
Like what? Like,
well, they're the ones that are, you know, the good guys are basically, they're really not a whole lot of, not to diminish the writing of the story, but there's not much to the characters. They're good guys. They're just, you know, stereotypical good guys. And any kind of, like, flaws or tension is always from the side of the bad guys.
Well, that kind of comes back to what Sean was saying at the beginning about Dungeons and Dragons, right? Is that Hank and the other heroes, they just get along. And Eric's the sore thumb because he's got a personality. I mean, that's the way you could look at it. I know that one of the things I've talked about in the past with Hoover is in the first three-parter of the Transformers series, one of the things about that really, like, makes it stand out as opposed to how the rest of the series, all the other 90-something episodes, is in the first miniseries, the weird thing is the Autobots don't get along. Everybody's disobeying orders. Optimus is always screaming, "Ironhide, come back! Blue Streak, don't do that! Jazz, what are you doing over there?" You know, and it's just Optimus is just mad all the time because his heroes just can't be reined in. They're not a military unit yet.
Yeah.
Whereas the Decepticons are very military, very structured. So, and then that changes very rapidly. Like episode 5 of the series, all of a sudden the Autobots are just like, "What do you think we should do, Prime?" "Well, you guys go over there." "Okay, we won't argue." You know, and what's interesting about when you look at that first three-parter is a lot of little moral moments happen where Ironhide takes off after the Decepticons. Optimus yells at him. Ironhide gets shot down, and Optimus is like, "Hey, you know, you really should be more careful because there's a fine line between being a hero and being a memory." You know, so
yeah,
like, little
always obey your parents.
You know, yeah, like that kind of those kind of opportunities happen more often. Whereas it
didn't Cliff Jumper, is that the one where he pulls out his enormous cannon and tries to?
Yeah.
Destroy Megatron there, and it's like, yeah.
And then Hound winds up getting almost blown up because of it, and then
yeah,
you know, Cliff Jumper's like, "Oh, I shouldn't have fired on Megatron." So, interesting dynamic change between that? Because then all of a sudden, like, by, you know, season two, it's the ones who are always dissenting are the Decepticons. It seems like every new episode, there's somebody who's out to, like, backstab Megatron, whether it's the Stunticons or it's Swindle of the Combaticons or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Autobots are pretty tight-knit at that point. And they got big personalities, but not so big that they ever break rank and do bad things. Like, the only other episode I can think of where an Autobot, like... Oh, there's two. There's, like, the one with Red Alert where he has that malfunction, and he, like, teams up with Starscream.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, it was a programming malfunction, you know? And
yep.
Then the other one is, like, when Ironhide decides he wants to retire because he accidentally got some of his friends hurt. And then it's all about, like, finding out whether or not you're useful.
Yeah.
Like, the moral message. So it's not really a matter where he says, Prime, I disagree with you. I'm breaking rank.
You'd brought up a point about, is it, you know, is it ever good to, you know, go completely immoral? Is there ever a need for immoral work? Completely and totally non-educational, non-moral. I mean, is that...
No social redeeming qualities?
Like, yeah, is that... You know, is that... I don't know. Is that a good idea? Is that something you can use to balance out?
Well, that itself is, like, kind of a tricky question because it's such a subjective idea. That's like saying, like, kind of like the difference between good and bad work. I mean, one could argue that by just not having a hateful message in your work... That it's essentially moral, right? Even if you're not, not projecting an agenda. So it's a tricky question. I mean, the closest thing I can think of off the top of my head that comes close to something necessarily being what some parents might call moral is: have you ever seen the Hellboy movie?
Yeah.
Like, the bad guys in that are truly, truly frightening. At least I thought they were. I mean, maybe I'm more sensitive than most, but I thought that the bad guys in Hellboy, like the guy who doesn't talk, who had, like, the mask on his face and the swords come out of his forearms, and then those demon things, the snake-like hair, I thought those things were just terrifying. And, I mean, to that extent, they were utterly reprehensible characters. Like, one thing Dan Mishkin said to me at HeroesCon last year or the year before, he was talking about Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld, and he said the key to the villains in that series was that they were absolutely beyond redemption. And because he was kind of like partially a reaction to this whole like thing that started with Star Wars, where Darth Vader is like, oh, he's just the weak man inside, and he could be redeemed. And the whole idea of a redeeming story it's a very popular and powerful idea, right? Well, how fun would it be to write a villain who is utterly irredeemable, who is without any kind of scruples or conscience, and what's more is actually kind of really, truly frightening. And then that makes it that much more, you're more invested for the hero's sake, possibly. I mean, to that extent, I mean, because the villains, but then again, that's serving a moral message, isn't it? It's demonizing your struggles in life kind of idea.
Yeah. I guess sort of like fairy tales.
Yeah. Yeah, then it becomes more like a fairy tale, doesn't it?
I mean, that's something... Go ahead, Mark.
What's that?
Were you saying something?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that, are we talking about moral as far as children's programming or stuff geared towards children in animation or just animation in general for moral messages? Because, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, case in point, I was at a concert a couple nights ago, and on the big screen they had just these absolutely horrible cartoons with unspeakable things happening. But, you know, and then there's that whole crowd, too, where you take a classic property and then you just do, you know, toilet humor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know there's a market for that stuff, and I don't know if I'm not trying to say, you know, give it a judgment call one way or another, but or if it's devoid of moral fiber or something, you know, I'm not trying to get on a soapbox, but
right.
Well, I was thinking like maybe along the lines of something like if you were to adapt Hansel and Gretel into a cartoon. I mean, at the end of the day, it could pretty easily fit into all ages content, but there isn't really a moral there because if you read the original fairy tale, the kids are just completely and totally mistreated, and then they get stuck in a situation where they have to, you know, like work their way out of it. It ends up becoming more about survival, I mean, like their father drops them off in the woods because their stepmom doesn't want them anymore. So that kind of, you know, casts an ill moral look on the father. And then the stepmother's obviously kind of evil. The kids just sort of wander around the woods until they find a candy house to eat. And then there's a witch inside that's going to fatten them up. And then eventually they have to kill the witch to get out of the house. And it's like, at the end of the day, there's nothing really... I don't know if I can easily identify, like, a pro-social message in that, other than it's just, you know, the world is scary.
It's almost like, yeah, don't rely on anybody but yourself. It's just kind of weird that to be thrown around at a kid. But,
I mean, it's...
Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that it seems like a lot of especially the 80s cartoons, rely on the structure of, like, the Grimm's Brothers fairy tales and stuff like that. And it's just it's just interesting, like, if you were to throw in an episode like that. It's like, at the end of the day, you know, parents read this to their kids all the time, but it really is, I mean, there's just nothing, I don't know, I guess I don't get the moral point to it, but yet at the same time, it's still an interesting, engaging story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a good period on the end of this sentence, and not to close the conversation, but I want to let Andrea Peterson in here in just a second, but I just wanted to kind of like round off this point so then we can let her in and see if she has anything to add to it. Dan Mishkin was saying at the Carytown Book Fest just this past weekend, one of the things he loves about superheroes is it's dress rehearsal for adulthood, meaning it's you getting to act out these situations through the hero and find out what's right and wrong. And to my own experience, I can attest to that when I was a kid, I would actually say, oh, Peter Parker wouldn't do that. You know, I'm not taking part in this business, because, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm wondering if that's in and of itself, by just saying the world is a scary place and you got to stay on your toes and don't do anything thoughtlessly. Maybe that in and of itself is the moral message. I mean, sometimes it can be that wide open. It doesn't have to be something specific, as if somebody says that, you know, if somebody makes you feel bad in the playground, or somebody's a bully on the playground, they just really want to be your friend.
Yeah, that's the case. I'll do that.
All right, I'm going to let Dan.
He's just jealous of you.
Yeah, that's what all of our moral messages are going to be in our future story arcs. Everybody's just jealous. Oh, I just really wanted to be your friend after all. That's why I punched you over and over again. All right, I'm going to let Andrea in here.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello? Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah.
Well, Andrea, let me introduce you to... What's that?
It's a bit, the phone seems to be skipping a little bit. It's probably my connection.
There's probably a little bit of lag time, considering you're on the other half of the planet.
Yeah.
So I have to be careful not to step on you too much. Just to kind of like go down a quick tributary here, Andrea and I are working on a project for Sugary Cereals together. Now, Mark and Sean, I think you guys have seen it, have you not? We've been posting some work on that in the private forum.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
Andrea, do you want to go ahead and announce to everybody what it's called? You can have the honor of that one. Unless you don't want to say just yet.
Well, the title is Minimum Wage Mages, and what else? Should we describe what it's about, or
sure, sure. Do you want me to start? I can go ahead, and you can just jump in if you.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, essentially, the premise is this: for those of you who haven't heard of this yet, it starts off with two girls, Steph and Stealth. And Steph is your Rory Gilmore type of clean living, gets along with everybody pretty much kind of high school girl, studies hard, you know, she's going to go to a good school someday. But she's not a super popular girl. She's not like a character from The Hills or anything like that. She's just a good, wholesome, all-American girl. And then Stealth, on the other hand, is a goth chick, which that's a loaded phrase in and of itself right there, right? I mean, you know what you're thinking when you think of goth chick. Little on the cynical side, maybe a little bit bitter, so you get this kind of odd couple relationship between the two of them. But the premise of the story is the girls go to the mall one day to apply for part-time jobs, and they find out that they got jobs doing what? You with me, Andrea?
Oh, so was that like you? I thought the sound was skipping again.
It'd be easier if I had video so I could, like, you could see my hands kind of pointing at you, like, and I feel like I'm...
Well, basically, they're both, I guess they both try to apply for part-time jobs and then kind of unwittingly end up applying or getting jobs as sort of magical, what is the term that you used before?
They're like not middle management. They're like, they're there to usher in the new age of magic.
Somewhere below middle management, yeah.
Right. Yeah, they're the regional managers. They're the regional managers of the age
I
of
guess,
magic.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so like, Stealth goes to, they go to the mall, they fill out their applications, and they wind up finding out that instead of getting a job at, like, the Hot Topic and the Gap, now that they're ushering in this new age of magic, and the age of magic has to have balance, so there's light magic and dark magic, but uh-oh, there's a slip-up, as there always is in an Odd Couple story. And Stealth, the goth girl, gets the powers of light magic, and Steph, the nice girl, gets the powers of dark magic. So poor Stealth finds out that she can summon a winged unicorn that makes rainbows whenever it flies, you know, and she can make, you know, little birds land on her shoulder and talk to her, which is every goth girl's nightmare. And poor Steph finds out she can make yucky bats fly out of her hands and things like that. And their job is to, whenever there's, like, imagine the age of magic is kind of like a shift change at a giant department store, right? So, like, the day shift is going home, that's the age of science, and the age of magic's coming in, that's the night shift, and there's always stragglers. There's guys who hang around the water cooler too long. There's people who try to work a couple hours overtime. So it's their job to usher out the people who just won't leave. So you got these magical girls fighting giant robots and giant death machines, Nikola Tesla-type guys. So... First episode's written, and I think it's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun working on it so far.
Oh, yeah, I'm having fun working on it.
So, yeah, hopefully we'll be posting some preview pages for that pretty soon here, and I've been a big fan of Andrea's for some time now, since one of my readers pointed me at her site, on your site, forthewicked.net. No Rest for the Wicked is an awesome comic. I don't know if you guys have read this or not, but... I don't know if you want to say anything about that, Andrea. I mean, you have the princess from The Princess and the Pea, right?
Yeah.
And Puss in Boots.
And then Puss in Boots and Red Riding Hood. And then basically, it's sort of a big fairy tale mishmash crossover type of thing. Sort of.
And you kind of do your own spin on the characters. Like, Red is not the Red Riding Hood we read about when we were little kids. She's a much more intense personality.
It seems I guess nowadays there seems to be a lot of this these Red Riding Hood type interpretations that are kind of dark and violent and stuff. I guess with Red, I wasn't really thinking of being iconoclastic. It's more like it just sort of became, it's sort of the fairy tale itself kind of just seems intrinsically kind of dark and gory in my head, so that's kind of how it came out.
Was it partially that kind of character was necessary for the story too? Like, it was like her, the way you approached her was like kind of informed by how to fill out the roster of the group.
Yeah, that's another thing, I guess.
Because, I mean, you got, like, between Puss in Boots and the Princess, you've got some pretty strong personalities. Like Puss is kind of in this urbane kind of... he reminds me of the oldest brother from Fruits Basket a little bit, the one who turns into a dog. And I can't remember his name. Shigure?
Oh, Shigure?
Yeah, Shigure. He kind of reminds me of him a little bit. This good-looking, tall, urbane guy who probably has a little bit of a... I almost imagine with a little bit of a British accent. And so you need somebody who's kind of like to pit against that. You need somebody who's kind of like wild and with no rules, and enter Red. There you go. Because Puss's reaction to danger is usually to try to talk his way out of it. Like, oh, we can work this out. And then Red comes in with a giant axe and knocks the wall down. So
they kind of have opposite approaches to things,
which is always good character writing. You know, it's fun character writing to watch. Essentially, you put them up against every obstacle and you say, okay, how are they all going to deal with this? And I think it was a wonderful touch too, how princess and the princess and the pea, like, the sensitivity of feeling the pea underneath all the mattresses means that she is hypersensitive to everything. So, like, when a leaf hits her face, it bruises her, you know? That kind of... Highly recommend people go check it out. It's a good comic. And the color work, whenever you do the color covers, is just gorgeous.
Thanks.
I was just going to ask if you had anything to add to what we were talking about writing the kind of stories that we're doing for Sugary Cereals. And Sean kind of went down a similar tangent, or a tangent that runs closer to what you've been doing with the term in terms of writing.
Fairy tales and stuff.
Yeah.
Whether there's like a certain moral message or something in the story that... Well, I guess I haven't really tried writing a story like starting out with the idea that, you know, this will have this certain lesson. It's more like if there, maybe while I'm writing, while I'm coming up with the story or something, I would sort of notice that, oh, I guess there's some sort of lesson in here that's like this or something like that.
So it happens for you, like we were saying earlier, kind of organically. It happens like you think about what
organically.
Okay. It's like an exciting situation that you start out with, or an exciting idea for a story at first, and then in the process. Mark, do you find that happens with you too? Is it something that happens more along the way? It rarely starts out with, like, we're going to do a story about stealing.
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily based on that. It's usually, that kind of happens along the way, or it's kind of like a something that would happen with the characters anyways, but usually it's more about some kind of plot device, or more about just kind of a general feeling of the story is where I kind of coming from.
Okay. So, and I think that's...
I would think it would be kind of difficult to do, I mean, well, it might be kind of difficult to do interesting, I mean, not impossible, but more difficult to make stories that way where you start out saying, okay, this is the moral of this story. I need to write a story about stealing is bad or something, but and then you start thinking of a story based on that. I think it might be more difficult to come up with interesting stories that way. I mean, I think that readers kind of probably might, or readers or viewers might, you know, they get the feeling that they're being preached to or something. It might be kind of difficult to avoid that.
I think you're right. I think that that's something where you have to be extremely careful. And yeah, again, we were talking about the He-Man cartoon from the 80s earlier, where happened. Yeah, it happened fairly regularly in that series, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing. But I'm wondering if it wouldn't be a worthy experiment, though. Like, Mark and I talked in one of his art and story podcasts about this idea of limiting yourself as an artist. The more limitations you put on yourself, the more creative you have to be in the final execution. So I wonder, like, you know, I think of on Leo Laporte's Tech Guy podcast recently, he has this photographer from Germany come on and kind of give everybody, like, photographic challenges. And one of the challenges recently was, do you remember this one, Mark? You got to take a picture of that demonstrates the idea of careful.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, it's just a dumb little experiment, right? Just you have to show careful in an image, and that's a nice, thoughtful exercise. So imagine if you did say to yourself, okay, we're going to do a story about – well, actually, I did have to do this now that I think about it. Last year, Sarah Turner and I had to do a series of small comic stories for Glencoe McGraw, and they said, do a story that incorporates the idea of friendship. What is friendship? And that was our starting point. And so what my attitude was, I came into it going, well, if I have to show friendship, I at least want to, I don't want to do it where that's all you learn, where that's the only thing that's in the story is, you know, friends are good and friends are bad, and sometimes friends tell lies, and sometimes they're to tell the truth, and sometimes they stick up for you, sometimes they don't. I didn't want to go that basic. So I infused this idea of, well, let's make it a story about science, where it's not so much about doing science lab experiments, but more like do mad scientist kind of stuff where they have to go in. The story was they found that these kids find out that the Bermuda Triangle is an interdimensional prison for cosmic criminals. And that's why people always disappear there, because once you get in, you can't get out. And so they get in, and they're fighting, or rather running away from all these 10-dimensional creatures. So I got to do all sorts of neat artistic experimentations where you try to draw something that has 10 dimensions, right? And so then you get like this whole scientific thing where they talk about how something that has 10 dimensions that intersects a world of 3 dimensions would look weird. So you got like a little bit of educational material. You've got like an exciting kind of adventure because you got a weird landscape and you got kids running for their lives. And at the end, the friendship of the kids gets them through to the end of the story. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So by having that starting point that I knew what the moral agenda was, it allowed me to say, well, how can I get to that in the most exciting way possible? It was a challenge to me to make this idea exciting instead of just kind of sitting back and saying, well, let's just show them at school and Julie tells a lie and the other kids believe it and it embarrasses the girl. And in the end, Julie apologizes and now they're friends again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that Sean just cast a gauntlet at me. Now I feel challenged to do that more often in my work.
Well, it's like you've got to be careful if you're starting out with an idea like that. If you're limiting yourself to trying to get across the moral, it's almost like you have to identify that, pick an aspect of that. Like you're if you want to show friendship, okay, well the characters are going to be friends, right? And then you almost have to put that aside and put it on another level and concentrate on something the friends would do. So that it almost becomes like background, so that you're not preaching, so that you're not just keep hitting on that point.
Right.
It's almost like you have to realize it and forget it.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. That's a very nice way of putting it, is that you have to realize it and then make it a secondary concern, and you make sure that your action kind of runs parallel to it while not bumping into it, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there we go. There's a nice little encapsulation of a healthy way to approach writing stories that are good for everybody. I think the simple answer though is, and you guys can agree or disagree, is as long as you're not endorsing ennui, as long as you're not saying, if you're not immediately good at something, kids, it's not worth trying. As long as you're not saying that if your enemy is bigger and stronger than you, they always win.
If you want to, yeah, just go back to that G.I. Joe episode where Cobra takes over all the TV stations. That's what
yes.
you don't do. Like the
yes.
likable.
Oh, nobody yes. likes me likable.
That's because you're different, Perpy. Only if everyone thinks alike and acts alike can we achieve world peace. And then
there's the one with the werewolf neighbor, I could be your neighbor.
Yeah, don't trust anybody. And then he changes the end of King Kong so that King Kong wins. And the guy turns to the camera and says, you can never win if your enemy is bigger and stronger than you. There you go. You just pointed us at like the kind of stories you just don't do if you want.
Well, you can log into YouTube right now and type in likables, and there's a 25-second clip of the likables.
Well, there you go, everybody. There's our YouTube clip of the week. Andrea, was there, I mean, you're in a different part of the planet, so was there any different shows that you would have access to that
pretty much, I would say most, pretty much everything. Well, I mean, lots of American shows, and then some shows that I didn't realize were probably from Canada or somewhere, and then some Japanese shows, obviously. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, G.I. Joe, Transformers, we got all of those things.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I just remember when we were doing the first live Saturday Supercast is that Kitsy and Kimono Stereo of Nemo Nemo, they were saying that, their stuff was more heavily influenced by the kind of Power Rangers kind of live action. What was the name
yeah,
of it?
Yeah, we got those.
Tremant.
We had those two, the Bioman, Ultraman, Shider, those kind of things.
Hmm. Okay, so then
yeah,
we
mostly watch, like, well, I mean, just in our family, we mostly watch stuff like, well, yeah, G.I. Joe, He-Man, She-Ra, what else? Macross, the original, the Robotech or whatever.
Yes, you saw the actual original Macross.
It was weird. I mean, it was dubbed locally, but it was, I mean, they called it Macross. And they dubbed it locally, but they used the same names from the Robotech version. So it was also Rick Hunter and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
So maybe they took the Carl Masek edits and just redubbed them?
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, it's probably something like that, yeah. It was also in English, I think. And then the one that was really popular here was Voltus 5. I don't think that ever went over to the States. but that was like that was basically that was really huge here. Voltus V, it's this thing with the it's basically like Voltron. There are five pilots, and then five of them, and then they each pilot a different vehicle, and then they'll all merge together to form Voltus V, and then it has this big sword, and then it defeats every monster in exactly the same way by making this big V-shaped cut to it.
In Voltron, it was, and maybe, I don't know if this is the same in Voltus V, but it was like, didn't the monster start out smaller too, and then grow, or am I thinking of Dynaman?
That happened early on in Voltron,
I think. That happened in Power Rangers?
It did, didn't it?
Oh, that was, yeah, because every, like, Rita would drop off some guy, and then he'd get shot with a beam. He'd just be like a normal guy, then he'd expand to, you know, as big as a skyscraper.
Yeah, and then they'd have to form the big robot every time.
Yeah.
And Sean is sharing a, is this a fan site that you linked us to, Sean?
Yeah. I'd never heard of the show, so I was throwing that out there.
Around here, there's this. Well, it's been said that... Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Hello? Oh, sorry. an error message came up.
Oh.
Well, basically, it's been... That was really popular, I'd say, late 70s, maybe early 80s. But they're saying that... Some have said that the popularity of the show is what led to You heard of Ferdinand Marcos? He was the dictator around here around that time.
Uh-huh.
And then basically he was thrown out in around 1984. And then they're saying that part of what led to his being overthrown was that sometime in the 70s he actually banned that show. He banned Voltus V. He had Voltus V banned, and then outrage from that caused younger generation to one day, in a few years, when they grow up. They say that, you know, he banned it because of the themes of they were fighting against tyrannical alien empire or something like that, and then, supposedly he didn't like that theme or something like that.
Wow.
Cartoons as a vehicle for social change. That's great.
There you go. There's no greater sign pointing to what our responsibility is as creators, right?
Exactly.
Wow. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's an awesome story that I'm going to use. So, guys, we're rolling in on an hour here of audio. I don't know if there's anything else you guys want to talk about this week. Nobody else is showing up today to really ask us any questions. Is there anything that any burrs under your saddles that you want to touch on today? On our first live episode, how are we feeling after being only 2 weeks out since launching the preview site? Sean, I gave you a blog account on the site, and you're welcome to use it if you want to.
Okay, cool.
So, and I'm going to be that goes for all creators. Like Andrew, if you want to blog on the site, just let me know. I'll make an account for you, and same for Mark. So, I would like it if I'm not the only voice on the Sugary Cereals page, because we're all part of this. So
I actually added the page to stumble upon today. I just started using that stumble upon thing, so
I used
the Sugary Cereal site, and I guess I was the first one to add it there, so
awesome. Yeah, let me say that too. Those of you guys who are listening, if you're enjoying this, if you like what you see on the Sugary Cereal site, please don't hesitate to, you know, either review these podcasts on iTunes or, you know, review it on the TalkShoe page. And link. We like that, especially after we get started the 30th of September. We're going to start updating every day. And then this will be let everybody know, because getting the word out is that's like 3/4 of the battle, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost harder than doing the work.
It really is. So, I mean, I'm doing what I can, but I'm just one dude.
You're an example to us all.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Am I really that great? Oh, good.
You're the black lion of the group.
The black lion. I guess I sound more like Keith than Lance, don't I?
No, form the head. Yeah.
No.
I'm just a leg.
Well, I'd rather be that than the Green Lion. What was Pidge?
He was a leg too, I think, wasn't he?
No, he was an arm. It was Lance and Pidge were the arms, and then you had Hunk and...
Hunk and the princess were the legs.
That's right. So, I guess we can always talk about all these other topics that Sean sent me in future art and story podcasts and Sugary Cereals podcasts. I know I'm going to be getting Sean on a pre-recorded one to talk more in depth about some of this stuff. But is there anything that we didn't touch on that you felt... on the whole and good for you too aspect of comics for this episode?
The flip side of the moral thing is the educational content.
Oh gosh, yeah, we totally skipped that, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the same things apply. You can be really heavy-handed, or you know, you can kind of just work it into the background. I think my favorite show that illustrates that perfectly. I completely missed this in the 80s. But Mysterious Cities of Gold.
I keep hearing about it. I've never seen that show.
It's,
Sorry.
Yeah, it played on Nickelodeon here in the States. I think it was a French show. It's really interesting. It's about a couple of kids from Spain that end up sort of getting forced into or getting kidnapped into a voyage to the New World when the conquistadors and stuff were coming over. And it's basically a search for the, Mysterious City of Gold, El Dorado type of thing. But they work in a lot of historical content. They come across indigenous villages and stuff like this. And it's, you know, when you're watching it from the point of view of just, you know, just the audience enjoying it, it's like, you know, this is all just a new, interesting world. It's kind of alien or whatever if you're not, you know, in on the historical references. And then at the end of every episode, instead of sort of, you know, giving you a moral message or whatever, there was actually a short little live-action documentary that went over all the things that sort of popped up in the episode. And it was just a really interesting... Because at the end of the day, the show itself was completely fantastical and, you know, it had a basis in reality, but only sort of. But there's still so much that was packed into the show subconsciously.
Hmm. I will have to check that out. I have never heard of it, believe it or not.
I've never heard of it either.
Yeah. Yeah, it was part of that block of like European shows that Nickelodeon used to show, like Danger Mouse and Count Dracula and Spartacus and Belle and Sebastian.
I mean, I definitely remember Danger Mouse and Count Dracula, but I don't remember ever watching Scary Cities of Gold.
Yeah, I know it was like I said, I think it was a French show, and I know it made its way to England and Canada, and then like I said, it was for a short while here on Nickelodeon. Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the Silver and the Periodic Forces, where you're naming characters with, you know, elements, and you've got all this stuff in the background that you're not really, like, slamming people's heads, you know, with the educational content. It's just there. You know, if you pick up on it, you pick up on it. If not, you don't.
Right, but right. Sean is talking about my comic that I did with Sarah Turner, Silver and the Periodic Forces, which you can find at mlatcomics.com. And yeah, the idea behind that was just that, was to let's try to do a comic where there's a lot of educational content, but at no time do I inform you that you're being educated. Right? I mean, that was like the agenda. And that was inspired by the Metal Men from DC Comics, where I remember very vividly when I started studying chemistry and I was like really plugged into the content because I was like, oh... So mercury is a liquid at room temperature, just like the character. And by personifying the elements through the Metal Men, it helped me retain interest in chemistry later on. And so that was my idea. Was like, well, let's see if I can do that. And I'm going to do the entire periodic table. And let's try to think about how does carbon act as a character? If carbon was a person, how would she act? And would it be a boy or a girl? And you just slip that in, and then you just also show what carbon does. Like, oh, carbon and oxygen are going to merge to become carbon dioxide. But I don't say, like, well, kids, you know, there's an oxygen molecule or an oxygen atom and a carbon atom, and they form together to form, you know, CO2. None of that. So
yeah.
That's kind of like what Mysterious Cities of Gold is like?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there'd be a lot of background characters that were actual historical characters, but at the end of the day, they're doing things out of history. But if you were to go back in and, like, look them up, you'd find them. They did very similar things, just in, you know, realistic environment instead of, you know, flying. So you focus
on the exciting aspect. You focus on what would be thrilling to watch first, and then everything else is kind of a secondary concern. Kind of like what you were saying, is like this idea of like you take what the story's about, and then you kind of forget that while you focus on what would be exciting.
Sorry, I don't remember seeing that in a lot of 80s cartoons that were American, at least. It seemed like there were more concerns with moral content versus educational content, unless you were going closer to the stuff that was on PBS, maybe like Electric Company.
Yeah. I was thinking as you...
The show that I watched before, I'm pretty sure it was from the U.S. It was called Crow, C-R-O, and it's, well, it's, I guess it's also educational, because basically it is about this Cro-Magnon boy who was adopted by the family of Neanderthals, and then it's set obviously during caveman times, and then the other characters are all woolly mammoths and stuff, and then basically it seems like, I guess every episode sort of you'd end up demonstrating some sort of science concept, like I don't know, pulleys or levers or something like that, and then usually he'd have to use these things in order to solve whatever problems came up during the episode. And then the mammoth characters, the way the mammoth characters are portrayed, you know, they're sort of very brainy and sophisticated and stuff, so they'd say, oh yes, this is a pulley, blah blah blah, so they'd be the one sort of explaining what it actually is. But you know, the main character Crow is just, I mean, he's just sort of coming up with, I mean, he just sort of, he says, oh, you know, he this stuff is just useful. But then the other ones are like, oh, you know, this is a so-and-so. It's a pretty enjoyable show, you know, I mean, because it would demonstrate various science concepts, but it doesn't really, I mean, it's part of the story, it's part of the characters, sort of.
Right, that actually sounds like a pretty interesting show. That's a neat idea. It's like the hero does it intuitively, and then the mammoths are there to kind of put the commentary on it. That's a neat idea.
Well, there's also, it wasn't quite as integrated into the show, but like Silverhawks, you know, it takes place in space, and at the end you'd have, you know, Copper Kid, you know, wowing you with his knowledge of, you know, what's the third planet from the sun, and...
Oh yeah, those little tests. They had the bluegrass would have it was like a class he took at the end of every episode.
Yeah, like 10 points, kid.
Yeah, I totally remember that, and I remember buying into that a little bit when I was a little kid. Like, wow, you know, I got 10 points. Bluegrass thinks I'm smart, kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess space is an exciting enough topic where it didn't seem like they were really shoving it down your throat too much. But
well,
I don't really know of any other show that really did that too much.
This kind of ties into something, what Andrea was talking about, what Mark's talking about, is this thing that Carl Sagan once said. He said that the key to, you know, like everybody's like, oh, we need better education for science. And he said, well, part of the key to that is to make science exciting. And if you've got dreary teachers just kind of pushing inert ideas on you over and over again, this is the way this works, and that's all. I'm not going to tell you why. I'm not going to make you engaged at all. I'm just going to tell you, give you this information, fill your brain with it. And you better, it's your responsibility to hold on to that information. But what Andrew was describing was something where they were making it a fully interactive kind of immersive process, and then the commentary is just there at the end to kind of say, look at what you did. Look at what you're participating in. Is just by the simple act of solving this problem that you have and doing it intuitively, you're participating in this wonderful thing called science. It makes it more of a. It sounds like something that Carl Sagan would have liked, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, and I think what a major component of that is just to map characters onto those things, to get the kids involved in some kind of role-playing, some kind of engagement with this idea, and instead of just presenting it as, well, here's the periodic chart, and this is oxygen, that's all, and remember its atomic number, you know, to put a personality on oxygen and say, Silver in the Periodic Forces, I decided that oxygen was going to be more of a bubbly, kind of happy girl, whereas... Nitrogen was more of a withdrawn and kind of cynical girl, you know? So not that that's in any way educational, but it gives you something to map onto those elements. You'll remember them a little bit more vividly.
Yeah, definitely.
There's that thing with, I don't know if I mentioned before on a podcast or not, but for me, like, the thing I would never, ever forget out of a cartoon was, you know, learning about DNA from Arise, Serpentor, Arise. You know, seeing the huge double helix in Dr. Mindbender's Nightmare. I never ever forgot that. So when that actually came up in school, it always came back to that. Any kind of little science bit that was, part of the story in G.I. Joe always really, resonated and stayed with me.
And then they had, I think two or three characters actually say, deoxyribonucleic acid, the building blocks of all life.
What's DNA?
Yeah, that one was a little bit more on the weird didactic side when Breaker would turn to Duke and say it like that.
How about when you're that young as a kid that it sounds like such a far-out concept and name that you're just kind of like, wow, what is that? And that's for real?
Yeah, so. Very true. It does sound like scientific mumbo-jumbo, and then you find out it's the real deal. So cool. I think we broached a pretty good topic here for a discussion about making stories. It's certainly a lot of food for thought. I don't think we came to any solid conclusions except that Sean, I think, coined one of those perfect little teaching sentences where you say to your students, you focus on what your moral agenda is and then forget about it. That's, I think, some of the best advice I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, sure.
It works.
So, well, that's all, anything that learning is. Just like Andrew was saying, is Crow found out what worked, and then the mammoth is just there to say, it works, and this is why. So, anyway, I think we got a nice, solid, rounded off discussion. We'll have to do this again. So thanks so much, guys. I'm going to go down the list, McLaughlin Group style, saying where everybody's from and where you can find them. If you liked what Mark Rudolph had to say, you can go to your local library or go to the website, cvcomics.com. Sean's thoughts, Sean's magical thoughts, I should say, can be found at brandedinthe80s.com and hopefully soon on the Sugar Cereal site. We'll see if I can't twist his arm a little bit. And Andrea Peterson, you can find more of her work at forthewicked.net. Is that right, Andrea?
Yeah.
And hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll be posting some preview pages for Minimum Wage Mages.
Minimum
so you can see
Wage
some
Mages.
Some of her amazing work on that. She's done some really, really awesome illustrations of the girls on their magical steeds, and it's just, I can't wait to show everybody. So, thanks again, guys, and hopefully we'll see you again, and I'll let you know when our next livecast is.
Sounds good.
Okay.